Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting today live from the Leo P. Flynn Gallery in SDPB's Sioux Falls studios, and it's time this Monday for the Brown Bag Book Club, and I can't tell you how delightful it's been every Monday this summer to have such wonderful authors from the region to join us in the studio. And today we welcome Phyllis Cole Dye and Ruby Wilson, and we're going to talk about their book, Poetry of Presence. It's an anthology of mindfulness poems. And then later in the hour, we'll talk about Phyllis's book, a historic novel called Beneath the Same Stars. So lots of territory to cover because of the writing careers that you have both had. Thank you for being here. Thanks for making the trip to Sioux Falls from Brookings area, right?
Yes, it's very pleasurable to be here.
So thank you so much, Lori, for inviting us. You do a great service for South Dakota writers to highlight writers from this region.
Thank you. It was wonderful for everyone to say yes so quickly on the schedule for this series filled up so fast. It's been a delight. This book is one of the books I picked up originally at the festival. When did it come out?
2017.
I picked it up at a South Dakota Festival of Books like that. You know, just from the cover. Hmm. I was so excited to see this book. Tell us a little bit, and let's start with the concept of mindfulness because it's kind of a buzzword right now. And before we get lost in what people think mindfulness is and isn't, tell us who wants to begin with how do you define mindfulness in the context of this book?
In the context of this book, that's an important qualifier there. First, let me say that if you don't care about mindfulness, you can still enjoy the book. But if you do have an interest in mindfulness or are curious about it or have an established practice, the way we define mindfulness in this book is mindfulness is keeping your head and your heart where your body is. In other words, your thoughts and your emotions are right here, right now, where your body is. There's actually some research out of Harvard a few years ago that suggests that most of us spend more than half of our waking hours distracted from where we are. We're either chewing over what happened in the past, or we're anxious about what's going to happen in the future, and we're missing what's going on right now. So the practice of mindfulness helps us tune in, pay more attention in a non-judgmental and compassionate way to what we're doing right this moment.
All right. What is it not? What are some of the misperceptions about mindfulness? And they say, well, no, it's not meditation. It can include meditation, but we're not talking about crossing your legs and sitting and meditating necessarily.
Hmm. That's a really good question.
That is a good question.
Yeah. Do you want me to hop in on that, or do you have an idea?
You can go ahead.
Okay. Well, one thing that it's not, we can look at it as a self-improvement project, and there's some perfect way of living that we're trying to get to. My experience of mindfulness practice is that it is a practice in being more human. Just practice in paying attention, being alive, and the more that I'm able to pay attention to others, the more I can tune into myself, and the more I tune into myself, the more I can tune into others. So that distinction between self and other becomes a little more crossable.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like a bad thing to be thinking about right now and practicing being more human at any time in history, but just with the pace is what I'm referring to, the pace with which we live our lives, how fast things are coming at us. Mm-hmm. That maybe is why it's a buzzword right now, maybe why people are drawn to it.
Mm. And it's not a way to perfection either, I think. Some people might think that if you're mindful, you're mindful all the time.
Right.
It's just something continual. You might be in the grocery store getting impatient because someone ahead of you is taking a long time. And, you know, just taking a deep breath and thinking, well, you know, maybe they have, you know, who are they? And you look at that person, you look at them a little deeper than just being an obstacle in your way. And that's one of the lines that's been kind of repeating itself in my head lately. We have these little, we call them fortunes without a cookie, and it's something we use at our...
I'm going to ask you to go ahead and pick up an extra microphone so we don't miss this idea here.
And fortune without a cookie is basically, it's lines from the book, from the poems in the book. And one of them is a line from a poem by Alison Luderman that said, if something is in your way, it's going your way.
And so when I've been, just lately, you know, life is so fast-paced, the summers, you know, go by so quickly here, and I'm driving, and it's like, oh my gosh, there's all these, and of course in South Dakota we have these big traffic jams, but all these cars ahead of me, and it's just like, okay, if something's in my way, it's going my way. So I try and figure out a way to be mindful in that and not be impatient and think my needs are so much more important than everyone else's.
Yeah.
But it's just something that we continually work at.
Ruby, when do you start making the connection between mindfulness and poetry? Do you come to poetry first personally and then connect it with mindfulness, or is it the other way around for you?
I believe I came to mindfulness through poetry.
Right.
I mean, I did not know what mindfulness was when Phyllis first started her first project, gathering some mindfulness poems. But I realized I was practicing it in writing of my poetry, because to write poetry, I would go for walks. I love walking out in the country. That's kind of, I love living in South Dakota and being able to do that. And, you know, ideas for poems would come up, and just paying attention. You're paying attention to your environment around you, even people, you know, family relationships. Sometimes, you know, there might be a family gathering, and you just pick out these moments that I think, oh, I could use that in a poem. But I always have to be paying attention to work on that, and pay attention when I'm editing and revising and that. I have to set time aside and be aware of that.
Phyllis, same question. Poetry comes first, and then a connection with mindfulness for you personally?
No, we balance each other out really well. Yeah. I came to this project through my own mindfulness practice, and actually I had been going through a rough patch in my life, and started kind of just voraciously reading poetry and beginning to notice that what I was drawn to had a mindful quality to them. Mm-hmm. And so I just started collecting, and there were hundreds and then thousands of these poems, and then it was a question of what do I do with them. So to jump forward to the anthology, when I knew that I had the opportunity to put this anthology together with Grayson Books, I invited Ruby to work with me on that, because she is a poet and she also pays careful attention to things, and I knew she would be a terrific partner in this.
Let's talk about how the rest of the world sees this connection. This is not a surprise. Lots of other mindfulness practitioners and teachers connect. Why? Why poetry and mindfulness? What is the natural sort of draw between those two areas of study?
Poetry, I think it's like it's a capturing a moment. And you approach it, I mean, you look at the poem and you know it's
surrounded by white on the page. And so you have to, you go to reading it in a different way than you would prose. And I kind of think about writing poetry as sort of distilling an experience down. So it's just very compact. But I must make the point, too, that not all poetry is mindfulness poetry.
Sure.
And, you know, the mindfulness poetry, our decisions about that were basically, you know, you might find a poem that you like that you think is mindful that maybe someone else doesn't. But it's sort of what works in your life at that moment, really. So many people hear poetry and they turn off right away because maybe they had a bad experience in school.
And let's dive into that a little bit, because that sense of, you said something about if it's poetry that you like and that you're drawn to, that's enough of an open door.
Right.
That is an open
door. If there's poetry
door.
That is just not for you, whether it's inaccessible or it's just unappealing to you, it's okay to not.
Right.
There's
exactly.
lots of other choices.
Exactly.
That's
right.
Yeah. And I give an example. My father, who is now in his 80s, at the time that I'm thinking of, he was wheelchair bound and couldn't hear very well, couldn't see very well. And the book was coming out, and you know, he said, "I'm never going to read it. You know, if you want me to read your book, you're going to have to write about something else," because he had had bad experiences growing up in school. So what I did is I read him a poem about the farm. And my dad's an old farmer. And by George, he decided he wanted to read the whole book. And when he got done reading the whole book, he asked me to send him more mindfulness poems. And so I was sending them by email. He was still capable of doing that with me at that time. So it opened a door for him, even late in life, you know, but he had to find the poetry that spoke to his life experience. And that's one thing that mindfulness poetry does in different ways, I think. Sometimes these poems be wrestling with mindfulness themes, like the unity of all things, or what do you do when you've experienced grief and loss? How do you work on accepting that? How do you pay attention to the sensory details of an experience that you're having? So these poems sometimes show us how to do that, or they recount an experience of that, or maybe they give us some advice about how to work with that. So there are a lot of things that mindfulness poems do, but they do it in different ways. And one thing that we felt strongly about in putting this collection together was trying to make the collection accessible to the general reader. So you didn't have to be a specialist in poetry or in mindfulness in order to find those open doors into the book. At the same time, we wanted the voices that we presented to be very diverse so that they would also stretch us and open us a little bit further. So there's a lot going on in the background of this book, but what we just really hope is that the reader will enjoy good poetry.
And you mentioned the farm, and one of the questions that I think is important about literature that comes from books like this that come from South Dakota, that come from people who live here, who make their lives here, who write here, who work here. The poems that you are going to select are inherently going to be different than if somebody from a different community. So even though this is poetry of very famous, well-known poets, there's also local poets in here that are names that are from David Allen Evans and Linda Hazelstrom and Lydia Whirlwind Soldier, names that we all know, who might not have ended up in an anthology for someone else's selections. Talk a little bit about the importance of literature and books and anthology poetry, writing that comes from here, comes from the place where we live.
And that is where I'm rooted. I did not get any formal education in writing poetry. I just was always drawn to writing ever since I was a young girl. But I was at home, when I was at home with my children, I was a stay-at-home mom, and I decided I was just sitting at home one night, and I wrote a poem. And so I started to get back into that. I'd go for walks and start writing poems, but I didn't feel like I had the tools I needed to really, how do you write a good poem, you know? And so at one point, serendipitously, I got a pamphlet from Linda Hazelstrom. She was just starting the Windbreak House retreats. And her requirements were that you sent in, you know, amount of your poetry or your writing, and she would decide from your application and your letter whether she would accept you for the writing retreat. So, you know, Linda Hazelstrom was kind of a big name for me, and I'd read a lot of her stuff, and I was pretty intimidated by it, but I decided to send it in and just see how it went. And she did accept me, and that was really a life-changing moment for me. Yeah. And as you know, Linda Hazelstrom, her writing is very much of that region. And I grew up in northern South Dakota. I'm really a South Dakota native. And so that kind of down-to-earth writing really appealed to me, and it was what I was doing that, you know, of the region. And naturally, even before I went retreat, I was writing from Dave Evans and lots of these local writers. And so just being aware that there are writers in this region who write about this region, I think a lot of South Dakotans may not know that. But it's so important because, I think there are writers out there in this state that would love to write, and they might just think, oh, you know, there's nobody else going to want to listen to that. But there are people out here, and it's so important to find other people that are interested in writing and read. I think there's nothing more important than reading poetry if you want to write poetry. I went to a panel discussion by Ted Kooser, and he made that point. He said, you should read 100 poems for every poem that you write. Oh, my gosh.
How are you doing with that, Ruby?
Well, I don't know. I haven't been keeping account, but I do read a lot of poetry. I try to set aside time to do that,
mainly
because of him saying that. So, yes, I think
it's
paramount.
The legacy of people like Dave Evans and Linda Hazelstrom in this region cannot be said enough.
No.
And I'm originally from Ohio, so this was one of my opportunities to get to know some of these more regionally well-known poets. And one of our great joys in putting the anthology together was to be able to lay side by side a Nobel Prize winner with a regional poet or so on. You know, so it's a real mix. But they are all very wonderful voices.
And they're, we tend to think a regional writer maybe it isn't going to be as good a poetry, but they're all excellent writers, and it's excellent poetry.
Yeah.
And it belongs next to that well-known poems, because those well-known poets started as, were not always famous. So,
And you got the new poet laureate in there without knowing that was going to be the new.
Yeah, Joy Harjo.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly. There
yes.
she is.
Wow.
And that was another influence, you know, with living in this part of the country. It was really going to be a feature of this book to include Native voices as much as possible. And mindfulness, of course, is not a concept that you might not associate with Native cultures, but they have their own way of paying attention and talking about what that means to pay attention. And so to bring those voices in so that we can be educated a little bit more, those of us who are not Native, that was really important to us.
We need to take a break. We'll be back with more from the Brown Bag Book Club today. My guests, Phyllis Koldai and Ruby Wilson, were talking about the book Poetry of Presence, and we'll have more in a minute on SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walls. It's the Brown Bag Book Club this Monday on listener-supported SDPB Radio, and we're talking with Phyllis Koldai and Ruby Wilson. The book that they edited together is called Poetry of Presence. It's an anthology of mindfulness poems, and they're joining us here in the Leo P. Flynn Gallery in SDPB Sioux Falls Studios. And I want to talk a little bit about what's the process, Phyllis, of really how do you think people should, you could read this as a poetry anthology like you would read any other book, page to page, dip in wherever you want to. How would you read these poems in a mindfulness way that would sort of integrate a mindfulness practice? Walk us through that.
Well, I think it depends on who you are, because your approach will be different. For me, I like reading poems aloud because that's where poetry originally came from. And so when you read, to take every word seriously, give your full voice, bring your whole life to the reading of the poem, is the way some put it. And so you're investing all of your heart, mind, and body into every word of the poem. It doesn't matter whether you do that one poem a day or five poems a day, if you're dipping in and out or you're reading consecutively. That's what I would recommend, is trying to make it a full body experience. Another thing is that as you get familiar with the poems, you'll start to make connections among them. Mm-hmm. And that's another way of paying attention, is what does this poem have in common with that poem? And if you feel like a certain poem is turning you off, instead of saying, I don't like that, you know, be curious about what is the experience that you're having, and inquire about what is it that's getting under your skin, and how can I enter into that without rejecting it? So you're practicing acceptance of the poet and the poem and the words, even as you're reading them and experiencing them. You may not end up liking the poem, but you might have an appreciation for it if you don't just reject it out of hand. So that's another way of bringing
mindfulness
to it.
Maybe it's the process of accepting yourself. You
it
might
true.
Learn something that surprises
that's
you
right.
as the poem sort of works its way into who you are.
Yes.
Will you read for us? I'm looking at really the first poem in the collection that you wrote.
Yes, this is on how to pick and eat poems, and it's outside the collection proper because I don't consider myself a poet, but it's meant to be a prelude poem or an introduction to the collection. So here we go. I'll try to put myself forward here on how to pick and eat poems. Stop whatever it is you're doing. Come down from the attic. Grab a bucket or basket and head for light. That's where the best poems grow, and in the dappled dark. Go slow, watch out for thorns and bears. When you find a good bush, bow to it or take off your shoes. Pluck this poem, that poem, any poem. It should slip off the stem easy, just a little tickle. No need to sniff first, judge the color, test the firmness. You can only know it's ripe if you taste. So put a poem upon your lips. Chew its pulp. Let its juice spill over your tongue. Let your reading of it teach you what sort of creature you are and the nature of the ground you walk upon. Bring your whole life out loud to this one poem. Eating one poem can save you if you're hungry enough. Take companions poem picking when you can. Visit wild and lovely and forgotten places, broken and hidden and walled up spaces. Reach into brambles, stain your skin, mash words against your teeth. For love, and always leave some poems within easy reach for the next picker in kinship with the unknown. If ever you carry away more poems than you need, go on home to your kitchen and make good jam. Don't be in a rush, they're sure to keep. Some will even taste better with age, a rich batch of preserves. Store up jars and jars of jam, plenty for friends, plenty for the long howling winter, plenty for strangers, plenty for all the bread in this broken world.
Phyllis Cole Dye reading on how to pick and eat poems from the anthology Poetry of Presence. I love that.
Thank you.
There is a certain amount of putting yourself out there to include a poem of yours.
Yes.
What was that moment like for you? Because I think that moment is instructive to the rest of us and really important for you to have done, because it's an invitation to others to do the same, to really create their own work.
I think part of being mindful is learning to let go of your ego. And my not wanting to define myself as a poet, or my wanting to put down my own work as an occasional poet, whatever, that's all coming from ego. That's coming from judgment of myself and all these sorts of things. But what poetry is at heart is sharing. It's connecting. And so to put yourself forward is really inviting someone to share the world with you on the page, and that's more important than who I am or who they are. It's our coming together that's important, and so that's the invitation of that poem.
Ruby, I'm hoping that you'll read something for us as well, and we might start with something that you wrote.
Okay.
Called Another Ocean, which is included in this anthology too.
Sure, I'd be happy to. This is a poem that really came after I'd read. I had been reading a collection by Mary Oliver. That was my reading part, you know. And it was A Thousand Mornings, and there were two poems in there, Tides, and the poet compares human nature to the ocean from which we came. And so I was reading these poems, I think, oh my, it sounds so lovely to be near the ocean, and I kind of wish I were near the ocean. And then I went out skiing, you know. I love to cross-country ski around my yard. I live in the country. And the words of the poem were working through, and I was encountering these things as I skied, and realizing that I come from the prairie, not from the ocean. Well, probably from the ocean originally, but anyway, I'll read the poem. It's Another Ocean, after Mary Oliver. I read her poems about the sea and wish that I lived near one until I remember the wind that weaves soil, grass, and sky, the design of fox and pheasant tracks in the snow, and the owl I hear at night who leaves fierce signs of its hunting nearby, and my silent ski trail that the wind erases through the prairie from which I came.
That's Ruby Wilson reading Another Ocean from the collection Poetry of Presence. And of course, I love Mary Oliver. Mm-hmm. And so many people do love Mary Oliver. And there's, what is it about her, Ruby, that has just transcended, you know, overcome so many people's resistance of poetry? But she's also was really, she died recently.
Yes, she did.
And was teaching us how to live in a way outside
yes.
of a consumer crush of culture. I mean, there was so much more to what she was doing that was really instructive. Talk about Mary Oliver a little bit.
Well, I personally am really drawn to her work because she walks, she goes on walks, and she's, again, really paying attention and describing ordinary things that we might just pass by if we're not, again, being mindful. And that, so, and it's what I do, and so I'm really drawn to that. But why the appeal? I think it's the accessibility, and I think it's the experience that everyone is drawn to, and everyone has experienced. You know, we just may not express it as eloquently as Mary Oliver does, but she draws us in. We feel like we're walking with her on that journey. And of course, there's always in her poetry a deeper side. It's not just about describing what she's seeing, but how does that relate? How do those insects, how do those animals relate to each other, to her, to the world? I mean, and what do they have to tell us? What does the natural world have to tell us? I think that is probably the best gift that she gives. Mm. The best I can.
She wrestles with a lot of themes too, that are themes for all of us. And some of my favorite poems of hers are about dealing with grief, dealing with loss and trauma, and without kind of wallowing in trauma or something like that, she helps us find a way through it, and or is with us in it. Mm-hmm. And that kind of companioning by a poet or bearing witness by a poet, I think, helps us feel understood, like we belong.
You've mentioned walking probably three
quite
times.
Quite a few times.
Quite a few times. And you know, there's a lot of outdoor themes. There's, I mean, you're outdoor people. You're,
yes,
you know,
we are.
Maybe all of us are in South Dakota to a certain extent, or we wouldn't live here. But you in particular, this is an important part of your life in the sense that also breaks down this idea that poetry, by some notion, is at a desk and, you know, or in the attic, you know, sort of an Emily Dickinson kind of theory of poetry. This is a very outdoor experience.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that, Phyllis,
well,
if you will.
Well, we didn't realize how outdoorsy the collection was until it was too late. But I think we're not going to apologize for that because that is who we are. And mindfulness can be a great teacher. Nature can be a great teacher of mindfulness. And so, you know, if you're taking mindfulness training, the same teachers who are having you dig into poetry are going to ask you to spend time in some way with nature, you know, because there's something about being in the outdoors that it humbles us, it helps us connect with our senses. If you go on a long hike, my experience is the person that I might be hiking with and I will be conversing a lot until suddenly we're not. And then it's just our feet moving and our minds still, you know. And there becomes this sense of the natural world as sanctuary. Now, it's not always like that, you know, but we find great sustenance there. And so, yes, there are a lot of tree poems.
Yes,
in
tree
here.
Especially.
And it's like, well, go out, and we're not going to say hug a tree because people don't like necessarily tree hugging, but that's what we're doing. You know, we're paying attention. And when those big trees, as they're coming down in Brookings now because of Dutch elm disease, and they're not there anymore, you recognize what they meant. It's just like a person being cut down in their life, you know, when they're not there
anymore. A tree in South Dakota is a sacred thing.
It is a sacred thing.
It's not a given.
And it should be everywhere, you know. Yeah.
And I was always drawn, I think, since I was a child, to wooded places. And I mean, I grew up in, like I said, northern South Dakota, and there are not many trees. But it just, I think, you know, a wooded place, there's a sense of mystery and a sense of you can walk in there and have some sort of adventure. I just loved it. I like to build forts and go through paths. Whatever path draws me, it's the same way when I go walking. It's like, well, which way should I go? And it's just whichever seems to kind of call to me.
So. Let's read some other poems from the book. Phyllis, what would you like to select for people to listen to?
Well, this poem is really on my mind a lot these days, so I thought I would share this. This is a poem by Alberto Rios, who was the first poet laureate of Arizona and has taught for a very long time at Arizona State University. He grew up in Arizona. He has a Chicano heritage. And he submitted this poem for our consideration, and it had to be in the collection. So this is called We Are of a Tribe. We plant seeds in the ground and dreams in the sky, hoping that someday the roots of one will meet the upstretched limbs of the other. It has not happened yet. We share the sky, all of us, the whole world. Together, we are a tribe of eyes that look upward, even as we stand on uncertain ground. The earth beneath us moves quiet and wild, its boundaries shifting, its muscles wavering. The dream of sky is indifferent to all this, impervious to borders, fences, reservations. The sky is our common home, the place we all live. There we are in the world together. The dream of sky requires no passport. Blue will not be fenced. Blue will not be a crime. Look up. Stay a while. Let your breathing slow. Know that you always have a home here.
That poem was called We Are of a Tribe by Alberto Rios, read by Phyllis Cole Dye. And one of the things I'm thinking of is people driving in their car and sort of having that driveway moment as you read that, not being able to get out of the car. And sometimes when I listen to somebody read poetry, I find myself falling asleep. And if that's your experience right now as a listener, that just means you're really, really tired and can't sleep. And it's okay, because I always use that as that when I'm in those moments where I'm listening and I just can't stay awake. I realize that that's the message, that it's time to catch up on your sleep. There's a lot more happening there. Mm-hmm. Ruby, what will you read for us from this collection?
I'll read a poem from a regional poet, Nancy Paddock, who is over in Minnesota. And I had first heard Nancy Paddock read at the Great Plains Writers Conference in Brookings. And it was before she had put any collections together. And I was so captivated, and I thought she needs to publish some of her work. But this poem that she submitted is called Lie Down. Lie down with your belly to the ground, like an old dog in the sun. Smell the greenness of the clover leaf. Feel the damp earth through your clothes. Let an ant wander the uncharted territory of your skin. Lie down with your belly to the ground. Melt into the earth's contours like a harmless snake. All else is mere bravado. Let your fists open into useless tendrils. Let your mind resolve itself in a tangle of grass. Lie down with your belly to the ground, flat out on ground level. Prostrate yourself before the soil you will someday enter. Stop doing, stop judging, fearing, trying. This is not dying, but the way to live in a world of change and gravity. Let go. Let your burdens drop. Let your grief charge bleed off into the ground. Lie down with your belly to the ground, and then rise up with the earth still in you.
Lie Down by Nancy Paddock, read by Ruby Wilson. All this is from the anthology of mindfulness poems called Poetry of Presence. Thank you so much for talking with us about this book. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
We have more of In the Moment with the Brown Bag Book Club. We're just going to transition to a new book when we come back after break on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting live today from the Leo P. Flynn Gallery in SDPB's Sioux Falls studio. My guests, Phyllis Koldai and Ruby Wilson. Their anthology is called The Poetry of Presence. And before we move on to the next book, I want to ask, what happens when you fall off, and find yourself in a spot that is anything but mindful? And maybe we could talk about how you got here today as an example of when things just come a little unraveled.
Oh, they certainly did.
Yes. Well, we were on our way, and my car stalled right about 10 minutes from the studio because I had not filled it with gas. Now, that was an unmindful moment, but we had to be pretty mindful to keep calm, and fortunately, we had left a little early, so we were able to make it, thanks to Christy, who stopped by and offered us help. So we just wanted to thank Christy for getting us here on time.
We actually had, I think, half a dozen people ask us if we needed help, and we kept saying no. And finally we decided, we're running short on time. We're going to have to say yes to somebody. And so Christy appeared, and we don't know your last name, Christy, but we hope you enjoy the book we left with you, and thanks so much for donating to South Dakota Public Radio.
This program is brought to you today by Christy and her generosity. I love that story for a number of reasons. Even going back to the moment of, like, I didn't put gas in the car, because that is just such a human thing. Like, we are all running so quickly that we forget some of those things, even when you're a poet and you have
that's right, especially when you're a poet.
Let yourself off the hook.
As we said, mindfulness does not make you perfect.
That's for sure.
And Phyllis, I want to talk about this book, Beneath the Same Stars, and it's a novel of the 1862 U.S.-Dakota War. You've been on the program here on In the Moment talking about it before, so folks can find that interview at listen.sdpb.org. And I'm going to read just a tiny bit that because I think it's poetic. And this is just the beginning of Chapter 8, and it begins early April. The wind softens, the land forgives. Tiny wildflowers bloom under the last snow. Frozen ruts thaw. The river ice cracks and breaks open with a roar. Thatches of green sprout in brittle brown grass. Yellow-breasted meadowlarks whistle. Noisy frogs swell in chorus. That isn't poetry. I guess I don't know what it is. So beautiful, poetic. So even bringing that sort of poetry and that mindful moment into fiction is something that translates pretty easily for you.
I work hard at it. I read everything out loud as I'm writing, probably too much, because then I get caught up in the minutiae of the sounds on parts that end up getting completely cut from the manuscript, you know. But it's part of my joy as a writer to pay attention to the sound, the way the words put together. When do you need a long sentence? When do you need a short sentence? And so it's just a lot of fun.
Yeah. And show us a novel through the eyes of Sarah Wakefield, this character who is a real person. Yes. This is historical fiction. Help for people who haven't had the background, help catch us up so we're all on the same page with what this story is about.
Okay. Well, I hope I can keep this short. Sarah Wakefield was born in Rhode Island in, I think it was 1829, and she, in the course of her life, made her way alone to Minnesota, where she married a doctor named John Wakefield, and they settled in Shakopee. And after the election of Abraham Lincoln, John accepted a plum political appointment to be the doctor on the Upper Sioux Reservation in southwestern Minnesota. And so he packed up his family, Sarah, and their two very young children, James and Nellie, and moved them to the reservation, where they lived in a small agency village with maybe 100 other white folks. And he was supposed to be serving the Upper Sioux tribes there on the reservation, but he really was not invested in that, let's put it that way. But Sarah developed an affection for the Indian people and would spend time with them, learned some of their language, would show kindnesses to them, and that ended up probably saving her life when the war broke out. On August 18th, 1862, she was taken captive with her two young children as they were traveling the main reservation road. That was the first day of this uprising, variously called the Dakota Conflict, the Sioux Uprising, the U.S.-Dakota War. And she spent the remainder of the war, this is kind of a spoiler, but she was in captivity, but she also was a participant in the family of the man who had captured her, and he ended up protecting her. She would not be have lived without him and his family. His name was Chaske, firstborn son. His spiritual name was something like Wichampi Washtedompi, which means he who is liked by the stars. This story takes us directly to Mankato and the hanging of the Dakota 38, which remains the largest judicial mass execution in American history. It takes us straight into tragedy. And some of the fractures that developed at that time between Euro-American settlers and Native people, and the fractures that developed within Native communities, those fractures in some ways are still with us today, as are many of the issues that contributed to the outbreak in the first place.
Will you read an excerpt from the book for us to sort of bring us into that space, please?
Yes. So if you have trouble with violence, you might want to listen for the next few minutes, because this is a violent passage. What I'm going to do is read what happened when Sarah was taken captive. So she's traveling down the main reservation road in a wagon driven by George Gleason, an Irishman. He has his dog Sadie with him. Sarah has her two young children, James, who's about 4 or 5 years old, and Nellie, who's almost two. These children are with her. They're coming up on an inn called the Halfway House on their way to Fort Ridgely. And they're planning to stop at the inn for supper. But as they come up on the inn, two Dakota men appear out of the prairie grass, and this is what happens next. This is based on Sarah's own words. The charge of shot blows Gleason back over his seat onto Sarah's lap, trapping Nellie. Sarah stares into his face, suddenly such a boy's, eyes wide and amazed, lips working without sound. She scarcely registers the blood oozing from his right shoulder before a second charge strikes him in the gut. With a groan, he rolls over the side of the wagon and lands hard on the ground. Sadie, his dog, bounds after him with a bark. Belle and Mick, the horses, bolt in a panic, pitching Sarah to the wagon floor. The runaway wagon is like a skiff on a heaving sea. She latches onto the sideboard and pushes to her feet. If only she can regain control of the team, she might charge the wagon on up the road to the halfway house. But there the reins are, trailing on the ground. Cumbered by the wagon, the horses are slow to gather speed. The Sioux with the red bandana has jettisoned his gun to give chase. Feet flying, he outpaces the wagon. When he draws even with the team, he makes a grab for Belle's bridle. The mare bites, kicks. The Sioux hangs on and wrenches her head to the side. Once, twice, again, she bucks, can't keep stride. Beside her, Mick falters. The Indian wrangles her in. As the wagon careens toward a halt, he lets go and tumbles free. When the wagon stops, the whole world stops, a bubble of quiet, bothered by restless hooves, an occasional snort, the odd jingle of harness. Sarah casts about, searching the wagon bed on the off chance Gleason's pistol spilled from his coat. Meanwhile, the Sioux scrabbles to his feet, dusts off his leggings, and goes to retrieve the lines. Sarah hides James and Nellie behind her as the Indian approaches. He's undersized for a man so strong, smaller than herself. I'll just tell you that Sarah at this point in time was over 6 foot tall and weighed about 180 pounds. So, yes, he was smaller than she was. She steals a glance at the wagon whip, still in its socket. "Haul," he says. He sets the brake. Blood streams from a cut above his eye. He stands there studying her. "Pijuhuta wichasha tawichu," doctor wife, her name among Shakpe's people. She nods. She hasn't heard that name in years. He motions toward her bloody dress. "Doctor wife no good," he says in English. "Washde wopida," she says. "I am well, thank you." The wiry Sioux lifts the reins up to her. "Doctor wife, horses." Not quite believing, she accepts the lines. He saunters around to the front of the team. "Doctor wife, no talk." His gaze shifts back to the Indian who shot Gleason. "Hey, pa, drink big." He natters to Belle and Mick, rubbing their necks and withers. "Shunka waka washde. Shunka waka washde." Good horse.
We're going to stop right there and remind people the book is called Beneath the Same Stars, and that's the first time these two encounter each other in a very certain way. That relationship offers much as the book unfolds. Phyllis Koldai, thank you so much for reading for us. We really appreciate that. Ruby and Phyllis, thank you for being here for this Brown Bag Book Club with both your books and for making a wonderful journey to get to and sharing that story as well.
Thanks so much for giving us an excuse for a story.
Always collecting stories on the road. Next week on the Brown Bag Book Club, Jim Reese is with us, and he has a forthcoming book called Bone Chalk. I'm really excited about that.